Morning, everyone. I'm going to bring up a drink. Am I good here? Nope. We okay? Okay. Check, check. Hello? Good? I teach a class, you can hear me now, at ACC called Presentation Skills and Graphics, and we have a very good debate about whether or not you're supposed to bring drinks on stage because it's a bit of a distraction if someone's up here, you know, drinking, but I'm just about finished with the sore throat, so it's kind of a backup. I picked up my kids from youth. It was almost a month ago now, and they're chatting away in the back as we're driving home and fairly excited about things. And so I asked them, how was youth? And they always have positive things to say. And then, I think in a moment of weakness, I said, is youth better now that I'm not in it? And one of my kids, I won't tell you which one, said, yeah, it is. It was a pretty quiet ride home for me. It did sting a bit, but I thought that's probably the best thing I could hear, really. Like what would I want? No, it's terrible, you know. So a big congratulations and shout out to Nathan and Rebecca, you know, for making youth a good place and a place that kids want to go. So that is probably the best thing I could have heard on that night home. So thank you for that. We're going to start here with looking at a verse from the book of Judges, and you can throw that up there, Mark. So the background to the story I don't want to share with you, because if it was put into a movie, it would be rated R for sure. It's a really disgusting story, and I don't really want to talk about it. I just want to talk about the aftermath. So something really horrible happened between Israel and Benjamin, a tribe of Benjamin. A disgusting thing happened, and they're about to fight over it. And so in Judges chapter 20, the verse starts off by flexing their muscles. Israel has this kind of a big army, and Benjamin has this kind of a big army, and they're about to fight. And so that's what I want to start reading just a little bit here. It says, but the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites, so they're starting to fight. From their towns, these are the Benjamites, they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their towns, in addition to 700 able young men from those living in Gibeah, however you say that. Next one. Among all these soldiers, there were 700 select troops who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. I want to talk about these 700. And sometimes numbers in the Bible mean things, but we can understand there's a big group of people that are left-handed soldiers, and they sling a rock and very accurate. And so the verse kind of stands out. In fact, somebody wrote a book about the entire verse, one book for one verse, and it's 100 pages, and I read it. And this guy's like, this doesn't make sense. Why somebody would go out and find only left-handed people and bring them in and make them expert sling people? And so he really started, the author looks into the history of military history, looks into the Hebrew, looks into the tribe of Benjamin, and he's like, it doesn't make sense. The word Benjamite is like son of the right hand. And in that time, you know, left-handed wasn't exactly an honorable thing. And so as he looked at the Hebrew and looked into the history, he discovered, or what his thought is that these people weren't always left-handed. And so he talks about being in the military. You got the helmet and the shield, and and everything's covered up, but your sword arm isn't. It's got to be free to move. And so many swordsmen got injuries to the right arm. Either, you know, it's completely had to have it amputated, or it was damaged so much that you couldn't use it anymore. And so now you're forced to be left-handed. And if that's true, this story suddenly gets really, really interesting. You know, if it's these people that have undergone this major injury. So if you think about it, and I'm going to go with that, I'm going to say, all right, we've got a group of 700 men that were once injured, and still are, right? They've got this massive injury, and now they're in this military. And I want to ask the question, how did they do it? How did they sustain this injury and then come back and sort of turn into these expert soldiers all over again? And so if you think about it, you know, you're in a battle and you get an injury to your right arm to the point where you you know, you've either got to have that amputated or fixed up to the point where it's not, you can't use it anymore. And so just that right there, like this, you know, you've got damage, physical damage to your body. Like, I don't know if some of you deal with chronic pain, but I'm thinking that's, you know, something like that, right? And you've got to heal from that. So now you've left the military and you're kind of healing because of this injury. And just sitting there with this injury, I don't know how long it takes to overcome like an amputation until you can get back functioning again, but you know, your mind's got to be playing tricks on you. Like, you know people that have had this injury and like their life is totally different now. So you got to be sitting there thinking, this is over for me. Like, I'm done. Like, that was a career, being in the military. That was your income. That's how you're the breadwinner. And not only that, but it's respected in society. Like, to be able to walk around town, people knowing you as a soldier, protecting the community, that's a respected thing. And you've just lost that. And so not only have we got this physical thing going on, but we've got a real mental story going on in our mind that can be quite, you know, change your life, right? You can really start telling yourself some pretty hard stories. I'm never going to recover. I'm not. Shame. I had to walk around town and I'm no longer this soldier anymore. It's probably going to have an impact on your life. Somehow these guys, they came back and became expert soldiers. How did they do that? Just imagine day one. Like, do you know what a sling is? In the old, a sling is like these two straps of leather with this pouch and the stone in it, right? And you're swinging this thing above your head. Well, come up and try it with your left arm right now. What's everybody like? Sign your name right now with your right hand. Now take out with your left hand and try and sign it, or shoot one way. Like, how long did it take them, with one arm not being able to use it, to become an expert at this thing? Like, could you imagine after like minute number three, like, my shoulder's already sore. Like, day one would be horrible. Day two, how many days would it take? Like, I think I would just go home. Like, is it gonna be a month? A month to be, and I'm not just saying that you can do it, well, I hit a target. It's like, I got to be in the army where these guys are relying on me, where I'm not going to miss. Like, I'm part of a whole unit here. It's not just like I can hit something sometimes. I hit something every time, like a hair, and I don't miss. How long does it take to get that mastered? Man, these guys are impressive. I'm impressed by that right there, to be able to overcome a physical injury and get back to that spot day after day in the hot sun, in a field, throwing a rock around the place. I'd be like, what am I doing here? Whoa, let's do this for 4 hours, right? Man, but they did it. And that's impressive to me. And not only that, I'm like, they had to overcome all of that, the shame and the embarrassment, and their life has changed, and maybe everyone else over there is on horses and they have their swords in their right arms and they're big, strong people, and I'm over here with my left arm in the air and I got my arm in a sling or half of it's missing or whatever, and it's like, I got to overcome that as well. And they did it, 700 of them. How did they do that? And where's God in all this? You know, like, that's a military arm. That's a spiritual army. Right? And so there's God's part of that whole society. I mean, I don't know. I don't think God is literally whispering to them, you can do it, boy. You can do it. Keep at it. Like, I don't think they literally heard the voice of, I don't hear him talking to me. I get encouragement from God in other ways, and I think that's probably true for them. Like, I have to read stories in the Old Testament, and I don't think God was doing any kind of special thing with him. Like, you know, Moses had his staff to split the water, and Jericho with the walls and the lions, and you know, there was no miracle there. It's just a bunch of regular guys out in the field with their arms in the air learning to throw a stone, and God is the same God for them is the same God that I experience, where I have to read about him and remember the stories from the Bible, and I don't hear him talking to me. He encourages me through you in other ways, right? Now I really like these guys. They came from a life-changing injury back into a really good spot. How did they do that? That's what I want to talk about. How did they do it? Right? I want to know. Like, I'd love to be able to do that kind of thing. Maybe they had a really strong family. Maybe they had somebody at home that was like, you're injured, I'm going to take care of you, encourage you every day and fix you physically, and I'll work double time. Someone's going to, you know, maybe grandpa's still in the house and he has to work harder, and you got family support. Maybe that's how they did it. Maybe that's how they went from an injury to way back good family support. Maybe that's how they did it. And so family's important. We should learn from that. You should invest in your families. You're going to need them someday. Families are important. Give, and hopefully your family gives back to you. Don't, you know, it's good to pour energy and invest time in your family, for sure. Maybe it was their career. Maybe they had a good career. Like back then, military, it's a important thing. It's helping. It's helpful. Okay? Maybe that's part of it. Like if I think my career is benefiting society, it's a good career. I'm going to pour myself into my career. Maybe that's what it was. We should do that as well. We should have careers that make a difference. I think that would help us, right? If we have careers that are good and helpful for society and they make a difference and all that kind of stuff. And if you're retired, maybe it's a hobby that it's still beneficial and good. And I know not all of us have that, you know, ability to be in a career that's really, really positive and beneficial for society. But maybe you can work it somehow so you're, I don't know, helping people in some way at your career or whatever it is. Callie works at the movie theater. It's hard to understand that could be a really life-changing, positive thing, but she could set little goals for herself. I'll just be an encouragement to people who come through the line, you know, things like that. It helps, I think, to be able to take your work and turn it into something good. Maybe they had good family support. Maybe they had a really good career that motivated them. Camaraderie. Camaraderie is a big thing. Being part of a group of people that has a common purpose and you're moving towards that purpose, that's a big motivator in life. When I was in Oklahoma, I went to university for 1 year. I was down there, I went to university. And, you know, they have those frat houses and sorority clubs. I joined one so I could play volleyball. And this was my Kappa Sigma Tau. We would walk around with canoe paddles, and you were supposed to decorate it to represent your life somehow. And I was from Canada in the States, so I put a bunch of flags on it, or a bunch of maple leaves. So, you know, to join this club, we don't really have them in Canada in the same way, I don't think. But anyway, they hazed us one night. They took us out to a field. They blindfolded us, took off all our clothes except our underwear, wrote on us with Sharpies, completely gave us a new name, took away our name, gave us a different name. It was an insulting name. And they blindfolded us so that we couldn't see the people that were being mean to us because we're supposed to be, you know, eventually brothers with them. Anyway, so here we are in this group and everybody over here is new and we're, you know, pretty much, they're just doing terrible things to us. And it's cold. And then they led us on this, like you have follow the leader. And so we're holding on to each other, blindfolded, walking through mud and trees and through a barbed wire fence and then back. And at the end, we have this big celebration. No, you're part of the family. It worked. Like, you really had to hold on to this person. And from that point forward, with a university of 2,000 people, anytime I ever saw anybody with a Kappa Sigma Tau on their shirt, I knew that, you know, that was my person. Like, I could just, you know, we were brothers kind of thing. I don't think we should do that. I think it's a bad thing to do, but it worked. And I think that's probably the same thing with these left-handed soldiers, right? There they are, a group of them together, and they're learning this thing together, and everybody sort of, maybe have to rub each other's shoulders because they only got one arm and all that kind of stuff, and camaraderie, and if you can have that in your life, a group of people, maybe it's your sports team, or maybe it's your church small group, or your gardening club, or whatever it is, a group of people with a common purpose moving towards it, that's a motivating, maybe that's how they did it. Maybe that's how they went from this injury to a real respected thing again. Probably a spiritual component as well, that those guys understood that their life was more than just this arm. Like, they understood that their life was more than just this, that there's a bigger thing. I don't just live for this and me. I live for a bigger, larger purpose. And so I'm hoping that they were able to connect again with God and live for something bigger than just their body. That's maybe how they did it. So there's our lesson for today. We can go. All we got to do is make sure we got a good, strong family and a good career that has a real strong purpose, camaraderie, and a spiritual connection. We're good. It probably will help. It's probably some good truth there, but I haven't really told you anything new. Like, you guys probably already get any self-help book, and that's pretty much what they say. So I want to talk about the left-handed soldiers that didn't make it. 700 of them did, but I'm sure some of them didn't. I'm sure some of them didn't even go to the first tryout. They couldn't even get out of bed. What about those guys? Like, the shame, like, I don't even want to be seen. And they just stay at home. They're all dead now, you know that? All of them. The 700 that made it, they're all dead. And the however many that didn't make it, they're all dead. And we don't know what happens when you die, but, you know, the Bible has these little pictures of what happens when you die, and we have these ideas, you standing before God, and first one comes up, and wow, God says, good job, you had this huge injury, and you overcame, and you reconnected with people, and you reconnected with me, and well done, good and faithful servant, come on in. And the next one, God's like, what happened? Like, you remember Jesus, you're supposed to come and have life and have it to the fullest. You remember that verse? What happened? You didn't live your life to the fullest. Your life didn't line up with my dream for your life. What happened? And the guy's there, I lost my arm, and it's physical pain, and he's crying. What is God going to say to that guy? And how you answer this question matters. What you think God would say to somebody like that? Life has chewed somebody up, spit them back out, and now they stand before God. And what's God going to say to them? Because their life hasn't really lined up with what you think normal life should be for good, religious, spiritual people. For whatever reason, life just kind of wrecked them, and they don't fit into what we typically think of as a good, responsible Christian person. How would God respond to that person? God's either going to say, no, you didn't live that full life, the life that I thought you should live, away, to hell with you. Or, I understand. I saw you. I know. I forgive you. Come. How are you going to answer that question? Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 5 that we're supposed to be imitators of God. As dearly loved, like children. We're supposed to imitate God or follow God's example. So how do you think God's going to respond to that person? And that's going to impact you and how you respond to people. And so we can kind of come up with ideas, you know, like maybe one of the left-handed soldiers loses his arms, got the physical pain, chronic pain every single day, and he can't work anymore for the rest of his life, and he has to beg. Street person. Becomes a street person for the rest of his life. Jesus interacted with street people. Jesus announced that he had to go to Jerusalem to die on the cross. He announced that. He's on his way, and he runs into street people on the way to the world's most important thing ever, and he stops and deals with street people. We have street people in Brandon. Do you know any of their names? So do you create distance between people like this, or do you get close? And how does God deal with people like that? Maybe one of the left-handed soldiers gets the whole physical thing worked out and the pain's gone and he can function, but not up here. Just like I said, just the shame and whatever it is, anxiety about being in public now, or depression, whatever it is. Do you create distance with people like that, or do you get close? Do you have people in your family that struggle with those kinds of things, depression and mental illness? So do you move away from that, or do you get close? Jesus dealt with people that had torments and spirits and things like that. Maybe one of those left-handed soldiers just could not find a purpose to live and just couldn't get over that and just went into the closet and got out the old sword and went out into the field and just fell on it. How does God deal with that? What would he say to that? You have people in your family that you know that struggle with those kinds of thoughts, suicidal thoughts. I know it's... I'm not saying that you're trained to deal with that. I understand that. I went one time. I talked to somebody one night that was struggling with suicide. I ended up crying. I think I did a terrible job of helping them. I know that's hard. I don't think you should do that unless you have training. But I want to know your gut reaction. Do you create distance, or do you kind of come close to people like that? One time somebody came up to me and said, Brian, my mom and dad are not Christians. They don't go to church, and they're dead. Are they in heaven or hell? Whoa. Talk to Cindy Hebert. Brian, I was in a Muslim village. There's people in there that they don't have connection with the real world. They born, live, and die a Muslim. They don't hear anything about Jesus. There's no way they could. Are they in heaven or hell? Take a child, steal him away from his family, give him a gun, turn him into a child soldier. He kills people as an 11-year-old, and then he gets killed. Is he in heaven or hell? Somebody's born with a genetic condition where their brain can only function like at a grade 3 or 4 level. They can't comprehend Jesus and his story, but they do things that are wrong, and then they die. What does God say to this? When we have people that life just has chewed them up in some way where it's very hard for them to fit into what we think is the Christian way to live. And it's tough because we have the scriptures, and step one to salvation is you got to believe this and confess this and this, and we got it. We know you got to have that relationship with Jesus, but then there's these people that, wow, what do we do? How far does God's grace and forgiveness go? How far does it go? And your answer to that will change how you treat people that don't fit into your kind of way of living. And it's a tough question to answer because we all ultimately don't know what God is really going to do, but we should be able to try and answer it. You know, you remember the people that put Jesus on the cross? They stripped him, and then they, you know, insulted him and made him bleed and mocked him, and then they nailed him to a piece of wood and they stuck him up on display in public and you know, crucified him like less than a human. You know, he's a sub-citizen. That's what he's crucified as, a criminal up there on the cross. What did Jesus say to those people that put him up there? What did he say to them, to the Romans that put him on the cross? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Do you think God did it? Do you think God forgave those Roman soldiers for doing that? Whoa. How could he do that? Criminals on the cross with Jesus, hanging right beside him. They deserve to be there. They said it. We deserve to be here. They were probably tried for insurrection, which is murder, and multiple murders probably, trying to start a war and whatever. Jesus said, you'll be with me in paradise. Do you think that's true? How is that possible? And Jesus said, you don't know what, that forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. Yes, they did. What do you mean they don't know what they're doing? They've killed lots of people on crosses. They know exactly what they're doing. I don't understand. They don't know what they're doing. Was he talking about those 6 hours? They don't know what they're doing, that they tortured him and put him on a cross? Or are they talking about they don't know what they're doing their entire life? Like they're raised as Roman children, polytheistic, multiple gods. They don't know the God of the Bible, Abraham, although they don't know any of that. They're not going to connect. They don't know any of that. Is it possible that God forget? Like, it would be like this. God's sending them to hell. Jesus says, please forgive them. Okay, I'll forgive them for those 6 hours on that one day, and then I'm just going to send them back to hell again. Is that what it was? Or is it like, forgive them, this whole thing is broken? Tough question. Tough question. How, you know, how far does God's grace go? Can it cover even that? Even the criminal on the cross, even the Roman soldiers that killed him? Got to have an answer for that. I think the way that I would answer it The book of Hebrews says there can be no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. Just pretend that that's a law. Just pretend that those words are written across the universe. There can be no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. It's like gravity. There's nothing you can do about it. You might disagree with it or question God. Why is that a law? Why didn't you make some other way to forgive sins? And you might not like it. Just like gravity, you might be mad at it. I don't agree with gravity. It hurts me whenever it's a law. You know, just for a second, just think about if that could be true. There can be no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. And then Jesus did it. And that thing is just fulfilled. And it impacted that very day he was crucified, which would mean there's a potential that the criminal on the cross could be in heaven because it's fulfilled. That law is fulfilled all the way up. Whatever the requirement was, it's all the way filled. The potential's there for that criminal on the cross to be in heaven on that day. And then the next day, what Jesus did impacts those people and me and you and everybody that's ever lived. And it impacts the people before the cross all the way back to Adam, which is why in the New Testament, Paul writes and says, all of Israel is going to be saved. How is that possible? Even the bad ones? How is that possible? Because of what Jesus did. Do you remember what Jesus said? Nobody gets to the Father except through me. That's right. Anytime you see anybody in heaven, the only way they're there is because of what he did on that cross. How far do you think God's grace really goes in his forgiveness? God says he saves who he saves. He forgives who he said that about Pharaoh, right? He can do that in Romans. He says that. Jesus did a beautiful thing on the cross. And we have hard questions out there. Are my parents in heaven? You know, they weren't Christians. Man, those are hard questions. I would tell people the potential is definitely there. What Jesus did was a very powerful thing. And I think God can look down and see a life and say, man, the world chewed you up and spit you out in a real horrible way. And I think he knows that. And I think God has every right to save whoever he wants because of what Jesus did on the cross. It's a very powerful thing, I think. Should change how you treat people. I think there's people in our lives that we think, wow, you don't think about family the same way I do. You don't think about career. You don't think about responsibility. You're not living anywhere, anything close to me. And you're tempted to create distance. I think of what Jesus did on the cross, and he allows us to be able to get real close to people like that. And that'll be my closing prayer for you guys this morning. Thank you.